Hello, welcome to Wheat from the Chaff. I'm Finlo Costain, the chief editor of 8.9.com.
And I'm Phil Carson, the UK head of policy for the Nature Friendly Farming Network.
And the first thing to say today is that we won't be having a guest. And part of the reason for that is that there's always a danger that we're going to lose Phil at any moment from the recording of this podcast. Now, we left it, of course, last episode that Phil and his partner were about to have a baby. Has that happened, Phil?
No, Finlo, it has not happened. We're still eagerly awaiting the arrival of baby numero uno. So, yeah, could be 2 weeks from now, could be tomorrow. We just don't know.
And how are you both feeling?
Good. I think my partner is a little bit fed up at this stage. I am trying to embrace living in limbo land, and that is bringing its benefits in some ways. But yeah, it's all good. It's all good. We're feeling good. What about you? How's things?
But you know what? This winter has been so long and so depressing. And I've just, you know, I'm realizing how looking out of the window or walking through the countryside, spring has oozed. It hasn't sort of rushed in any way at all. The blackthorn has been and gone. Petals already being bashed off, and the bluebells are here, and yet the celandines and the daffodils, I haven't seen a ray of sunshine, I don't think, on them at all. And one of the joyful moments that I have in an average spring is when the blossom comes out on the apple tree, and I like to just sit really close of a Saturday afternoon in the sunshine, just sort of grab half an hour with the Financial Times or something, and sit down with the insects buzzing, the bees there enjoying the blossoms. And at the moment the blossoms are just coming out, and I'm just thinking, no, go back in again, because I'm so scared that they're just going to be bashed by the rain and the wind, and just, you know, even more of spring that's lost. And I kind of think about this from a personal perspective, but the reality is that farmers are dealing with this. You know, it's their livelihoods, and they've had 6 months and more of rain and wind and storms and awful weather. I mean, it's just horrendous.
Yeah, it's pretty bleak. We've had one of the wettest winters on record, and we've had major, major issues for farmers trying to get crops in. They're losing crops as well, already been established. And now we're moving into spring, and similar issues are being faced across the board. I was reading recently we're on track for one of the worst harvests on record, which I suppose is to be expected, but is depressing in its own right. And you speak to some farmers out who are lambing at the moment, and they're just having an absolutely awful time. So they're losing lambs at an unprecedented rate, and some are having to move indoors as well as a result of that too. So it's really, really challenging out there, and you just have to feel for them.
Absolutely. And that brings us on to the first story, which is from the Country Land and Business Association, who are just calling on the government, who promised money, promised flood relief to farmers back in January around the time of Storm Henk. Grants of up to £25,000. Just saying that money needs to be available. And so we've got a situation where the government's come out with a nice press release, a bit of PR, where they're saying, yes, we recognise farmers are having it tough, promising the money, but it's still not there. And since then, we've had 3 more months of rain and storm, and it's just not acceptable.
Yeah, I think this needs to be actioned as a matter of urgency. If you commit to something, then you follow through as quickly as you possibly can. And there will have been farmers who have seen this and are desperate for it and are waiting for it to open at the earliest opportunity to really deal with some very serious consequences on their farm. So I suppose it's a plea as much as anything to get this in place as quickly as possible.
And the reality is that this is just a portent of things to come, isn't it? I mean, it may well be that, you know, the El Nino this year has meant that it's even wetter, but we are very rapidly moving to a Britain where we have a wet season in the winter, a dry season in the summer. We need some serious soil resilience to be able to soak up the water and then make sure that it still exists when the drought comes in, which inevitably it will at some point during the summertime. And so we have this challenge of the immediate need here, which is money, and the slightly more medium term need, where we need to think about what we're actually producing, the food that we're producing, what's coming from the land, and think about the way that our systems are working so that we can adapt farm businesses and adapt the land to face this sort of weather on a very regular basis in the future.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. This is the year, I suppose, 2023, 2024 is the year when climate, I suppose, the impacts of climate change have become a very challenging reality. And this points to the need for long-term planning, but to start implementing some of this stuff now. And we're seeing a lot of rhetoric, a lot of narrative around the impact on food production of delivering environmental land management and of schemes taking away from that. At the same time, we're having to contend with big flooding events, really unpredictable weather, And you almost want someone to join the dots and say, actually, we need to change the way we farm to deliver a more adaptable and resilient landscape. And this is how we're going to do that. And that's absolutely crucial within this. And I think it also points to the need and also the concerns around the absence of a land use framework. So some of the things that we need to see will probably result in pretty significant changes in land use and what's being farmed and where it's being farmed and how it's being farmed. And we need to have an overview and a picture of what that potentially looks like in different areas so you can build adaptability into the system as a whole. It's pretty clear the way we're doing things now isn't going to be sustainable next year, let alone in 10. So we really need to get a move on with some of this stuff. And you're right, this scheme is crucially important in terms of addressing the short-term impacts and devastation caused this year, but we can't be paying out every single year to address the consequence of this stuff. We need to be able to deal with them.
And so much of this is a consequence of the way that we have simplified the way that we produce food, you know, which has been very successful for decades. Obviously, we've built up these external costs, but we have essentially taken ourselves away from nature. We've enabled ourselves to be able to produce food regardless of the weather. But now the weather is changing to such a great extent that it's kind of caught us up again. And unless we relearn how to create that resilience in the land, then, as you say, we're just going to continue having this problem, continue firefighting year on year on year. And so we need to look at different ways potentially of managing land which is being regularly flooded. And it may well be, for example, that that's land that's better to be used for natural capital purposes, or that farmers could be producing willow, which is a crop that doesn't mind getting its feet wet in the same way. There's going to be plenty of need for, you know, more wood, as we've discussed in the past. Are there things that farmers can do with that land which doesn't just involve trying to do the same thing but in a slightly different way and continuing to struggle?
Yeah, and I think we should be framing it in a sense that doing this is a contribution towards food security. Doing this in a way is providing business opportunities as well, at which a very narrow focus on old systems of food production have left you only producing one thing, have left you very vulnerable to market changes. And I think, yeah, we need to completely reimagine how we're doing things for greater economic, environmental and social resilience.
And of course, one of the ways that some farmers might try to compensate for the amount of wetness that's around is by thinking about ways of going more indoor, more fully indoor than they currently are. But of course, if you do that with your livestock, then the dependence on feed that's produced out in those fields increases further still. And of course, then you have the problem of what on earth to do with the slurry that comes away, the feces from those livestock that have been kept indoors. And slurry has been an enormous problem this year as well, of course, with animals being taken inside earlier, certainly being let out into the fields later. Around here, for example, the cattle were let out, but they've been taken back in again because the weather's just been so awful. So we've had this second story on the website, slurry pollution as damaging as sewage. This was Peter Powell, the chief executive of the Welsh D Trust, who drew attention to three particular recent slurry pollution incidents in Wales, North Wales, I think, in particular, each of which, he says, would have been devastating to wildlife in the Dee, in the river. We interviewed him for 8.9 TV. That's also available on the 8.9 Newsweek podcast. The audio of that can be heard. And when I asked him, the way that he described this sort of, you know, what does devastation mean? Well, you know, how do we define a particularly bad slurry pollution incident? And he said it was down to fish kills. So we're talking about slurry to the extent where the wildlife in the river is being killed as a result of it going there. And he says the high concentration of excreta in slurry means that each pollution event is even more damaging than storm discharges from human sewage overflows, which of course are diluted to a much greater extent. He says that slurry is getting into rivers from two primary sources. Firstly, from being spread on land in bad conditions, for example, before or even during heavy rain or onto frozen ground. And then secondly, the slurry is escaping from farmyards down clean water drains or overflowing from storage, because there's just so much slurry that there isn't enough storage on the farmyards to cope with it. Now, by law, farms are required to have at least 4 months storage now, depending on location and the type of animal that's farmed there. And in nitrate vulnerable zones, they're required to have even longer storage. But it's still just not enough in terms of this last winter. And Powell says, in terms of North Wales, where he is, you know, most farms don't have that 4 months of storage. And there are some with as little storage as a week.
Yeah, so we've seen that as soon as the season has opened and we've moved into February, that there's a lot of farmers out in tractors just getting rid of slurry, even though the conditions just aren't right. The ground is waterlogged. Sometimes it's actually raining whenever it's taking place. And yeah, it's as a result of not having enough storage to kind of go through the winter. And I think Peter's points in terms of trying to address this brings challenges, and there's no easy solution in terms of the costs associated with these. So it's either increase your storage, move towards a more straw-based system, or to try and stop rainwater from getting in through different, I suppose, from fixing, you know, broken infrastructure. None of these are easy to do. Well, they're easy to do, but not without cost. And there's a question here of, how do we do this and address these very quickly? And I think there's also points in relation to how the current rules are enforced and regulated, and how that can actually compel people to invest in this sort of stuff. And then I think there's also the role of kind of what government and what role they play within this too. But for me, I think some of this stuff is potentially tinkering around the edges or trying to address a symptom of something as opposed to the cause. And we really have to question whether there is a long-term kind of future for some of these systems, because it's not just slurry that we're having to deal with here. Whenever we're putting more animals indoors, we're having to deal with ammonia emissions, we're having to contend with animal welfare issues, all these sorts of things as well, which realistically, or is that what we want from food and farming? Again, this is a very difficult conversation to have, but what is the viable pathway out of that? Because a lot of people have invested in these systems in good faith or have moved towards adopting them to try and address problems, but they're not actually a sufficient solution in many cases.
And of course, Peter's solutions are about trying to deal within the system that we currently have, for example, with seasonally grazed dairy systems, where slurry is part of that, where we're trying to work at how we can make that slurry work better. But there is a fourth solution, which is to look at the way that you're actually managing those livestock, particularly the grazing management. And although adaptive multi-paddock grazing, for example, regenerative grazing, you know, is something that we tend to see in beef systems more than dairy systems, there are ways of changing the way that dairy systems are grazed, which are more regenerative, which potentially, even if they don't allow you to outwinter, on a kind of a whole winter basis, they will allow you to go for longer over the autumn, to stay outside for longer, and then to come outside again earlier in the process, so that you're not just trying to deal with the slurry situation because you standardly bring your stock in November and standardly let them out again in March. You're actually trying to extend that grazing period so that you have less of a slurry issue in the first place.
Totally. And I think if we can actually look at ways of achieving that goal in its own right, that helps to reduce the costs of the business as well, because housing costs are the biggest single cost that a livestock system is going to incur over the course of the year. And there is precedent for this in agriculture policy. So say, for example, in addressing ammonia emissions, quite a few parts of the UK have said that they want to see the grazing season extended. And there's clearly a role for more regenerative systems and farming practices in helping to achieve that goal.
And again, it's about dealing with the immediate issue, fighting the fire that's already blazing at the same time as trying to deal with that issue in the medium term. When I say medium term, really I'm talking about, you know, in the next year or two or three, how do you change your system so that it's more resilient in that sort of time frame? But you still have the problem now. If you have slurry that's overflowing, what do you do with it? And, you know, the worst of all worlds is to let that overflow in a farmyard situation where it's going fairly undiluted just straight into the watercourses, if those watercourses are present. And when I was talking to Peter Powell about it, he said, well, look, the only thing that people can really do at this stage, if they are overflowing, is just to try and find a dry afternoon, a dry day somewhere, and get it out on the fields and spread it as thinly as possible so that it has the least possible impact. Phil, let's take a break. And we're back, and in this section we're going to talk about two stories. We're going to talk about the Nature Friendly Farming Network's general election manifesto, Phil, and then after that we're going to talk about the idea of a universal basic income for farmers. But let's start with the general election manifesto, and also just to say that I interviewed Martin Lines, the chief executive, your boss of the Nature Friendly Farming Network, spoke to him for 8.9 TV, which is there available on the 8.9.com website. But also, if you want to listen to the audio of that, it's there in the 8.9 Newsweek podcast, which is available on the same channel, of course, as Wheat from the Chaff. So the Nature Friendly Farming Network has unveiled its manifesto ahead of the upcoming UK general election. You developed a 7-point plan that's asking the next UK government to implement to ensure that there is a positive future for food production and the protection of nature. And just to very quickly run through these things, you're looking for a fit for purpose agricultural budget, a fair and transparent supply chain, core trading standards so that farmers aren't undercut, action to support people to enjoy healthier and more sustainable diets, ambitious schemes that make nature-friendly farming easier, better regulation, and building support and advice for better skills and knowledge in the countryside. So there's a range of different things there. Can we start with the fit for purpose agricultural budget? How much is it and how well costed is it, Phil?
Yes, so we have started with a figure of £6 billion per annum, which is a significant increase on what we currently get. So the UK budget is about 3.4 to 3.7 billion per year. And that has been, I suppose, calculated on a relatively arbitrary basis in the past. What we're calling for is a significant uplift, and that is to deliver a whole range of different things, but principally it's to deliver environment and climate outcomes. And the most robust piece of evidence that suggests how much is required to deliver that was a piece of work that was undertaken, or I suppose commissioned, by a number of the environmental organisations, and that comes out with a figure of £4.4 billion worth per year as a minimum to deliver on our current legal commitments for nature and climate. But we also want an agriculture budget to do a whole range of different other things as well. So we're asking for increased access. That's a debate that is very, very live at the moment, and that needs to be paid for and supported for. So we want to see investment in that. We also need to see investment in that, I suppose, supporting infrastructure to actually ensure that, farmers benefit from a lot of this sort of stuff, and rural communities benefit from a lot of this stuff as well. We used to have a rural development programme in the EU, which provided investment in farm family skills, in leader, all those sorts of things as well. And we want to see investment on that front as well. Those elements are not costed up, but we imagine that at least £1.6 billion is required to deliver all of those across the UK as well. Last bit is just the level of kind of efficiency within public spend as well. So quite often public expenditure is inefficient, and you need to have a little bit of flex within your budget too. So yeah, we think our figure allows for that as well.
Now, you mentioned that it was a fairly arbitrary budget that existed. And of course, the reality is that we've moved from one system of paying farmers and trying to value the work that farmers do to a completely different one. And we've just used the same pot of money to a large extent. So we've sort of gone from an acreage payment under the Common Agricultural Policy, which was essentially an income support payment for farmers. And now we've changed that to very specific payments for public goods for a range of different environmental outcomes. And so it seems to me that there is a real need after the next election to have some kind of a commission or some kind of an inquiry which says, you know, look, we can't just take the same pot of money and then demand something different for it. What are the outcomes that we want to deliver, and what is that actually going to cost?
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think the work that I've mentioned previously is a good stab at trying to calculate what is needed, but that's looking at a very, very narrow set of what we want from our countryside and what we want farmers to do. We need to look at all of those objectives, as you say, in the round, and come up with an accurate figure and make that business case as well, because that's going to be really, really crucial in terms of securing this budget. How much do we actually need to deliver all these things?
Another thing that you're wanting is a fair and transparent supply chain, Phil. What's that? What does it look like? Because often when we talk about regenerative agriculture and agroecological agriculture, we're talking about supply chains, not necessarily that are fully independent, but they're fairly independent, or else you have sort of smaller consortia working together to bring those products to market. So I guess part of the question question is, how do we deliver that fairness and transparency at the same time as scaling that agroecological approach?
Yeah, it's a very, very good question. And the general principle that we're pointing out here is that we need to see a fair return for public goods, which is the agriculture budget, and we need to see an equally fair return for the private goods that are going into the marketplace as well. And we want to see some of the powers that are within the UK Agriculture Act actually being used in this respect. And there are powers in there to actually, to collect more data on the supply chain, to actually understand who is benefiting out of this, who is benefiting the most out of this, and where are those areas, I suppose, of inequity and unfairness within that as well, to try and address those. We've seen some steps to try and create fairer dealing practices. So we've seen codes of conduct for various different sectors in terms of contractual agreements, but we need to see more on that front. And we would also support the work of Riverford and Sustain in calling for greater powers for the grocery codes adjudicator as well, so that they can actually regulate the supply chain in a more effective way. We think those would be some of the big steps that could be taken here to try and address this issue.
Thanks, Phil. The last thing that I wanted to sort of pick out from the manifesto at this point was kind of a wrapping together of two or three of those things that you're calling for into a heading, I guess, of investment in people and place and investment in rural development and the rural economy. Can you just talk us through a bit of that?
Yeah, of course, because this is the investment in people within the agriculture transition. And I think what we've seen to date is, quite a technocratic kind of top down. This is what the state wants farmers to do. And here are some of the broad tools to be able to deliver that. And quite often that's an online system, an online training course, whatever it would be. We're calling for really, really significant changes in how we manage land, how we approach businesses, all those sorts of things. And people are absolutely critical within that. And investing in people to help farmers in that transition and to support them in that transition is going to be absolutely integral in actually delivering success. So that's talking about advice. We know that environmental land management advice is really key in delivering better environmental outcomes, but also in driving up support and buy-in from farmers for the schemes. Greater understanding of the fact that delivering some of this stuff does provide environmental but also business benefits at the same time. Then we're looking at how do you upskill farmers within this to almost act as agents of change within this, so that they are equipped to kind of demonstrate the value, not just to them, but their neighbours and other farmers through knowledge exchange. I think that's also really key. And then the other element of this too is just broader rural development. And this is what we'd see part of the budget paying for, but is those local supply chains, that investment in skills for farmers and farm families to actually integrate some of this stuff with confidence and with certainty as well.
The rural economy seems to have been sort of gutted so to such an extent over the last 30 years or so, where you have farms that are sort of operating almost independent of their communities, at the same time as you have dormitory villages growing up where people live there, but then they migrate to cities to do their jobs. And so what we're talking about is trying to reverse the brain and skills drain that's kind of happened in favour of urbanised places and cities where people go to work, and bringing people back out, giving them good lives and good opportunities within a thriving rural landscape.
Exactly. It's about realising the vision of what these places can actually achieve and putting in place the building blocks to actually get there, because we have such opportunity and such potential in our rural economies to deliver a huge amount for society, but also to do that with economies that kind of thrive in their own right. And I think that requires long-term and like quite visionary investment as well to get there. And we think what we've put forward is we'll put some of the steps towards that.
So that's your solution. That brings us on to another solution, which is farmers demand a universal basic income. So a group of farmers are suggesting, the article says, demanding a universal basic income, a UBI, to provide financial security as the UK transitions away from historic EU subsidies. A basic income for farmers would be a regular, unconditional cash payment. What do you think about that, Phil?
I think the work that this report, I suppose, and this ask has done has highlighted some of the major challenges facing farmers at the moment and some of the major challenges associated with transitioning towards a new agriculture policy. There can be no denying that. I think the call for a universal basic income is not the solution required to address some of these challenges.
Why not?
There's a range of different reasons. So I've spoken about the work that we've done to advocate for a fit for purpose agriculture budget, the Nature Friendly Farming Network. So we've called for £6 billion. If you look at an unconditional cash payment to be made to all agricultural workers, so there's about 307,000 agricultural workers working in the UK at the moment. If they were to be paid £1,600 a month, which is the current payment that's being used to trial UBI in other parts of the UK or in specific trials, at a national scale, that would take up £5.8 billion worth of expenditure. So on a universal basic income alone,
and what are people getting back for that? Because again, it's this idea that it's unconditional.
Well, yeah, it's unconditional on practice. It's unconditional on I suppose the size of the farm. It's for everyone, regardless of what you're doing. And you can understand, I suppose, the rationale for that at a societal level. But whenever we're looking at it from an agricultural perspective and you're taking away from other priorities of which that money could deliver, then I think that's quite problematic. The other point here as well is we've had decades of relatively unconditional payments. And one of the rationales behind a UBI for farming is so that farmers can invest in agroecological land management, which hasn't really been done, even though we have had quite significant sums of public money going into agriculture. So I think you do need to have some sort of guiding framework to get people to where you want them to be. And then the other question around this, and I think that's a fair point, is dealing with the economic challenges of policy change, trying to look at how you can support farm workers to be paid fairly, how can you support new entrants into the sector. Those are all worthy aims. But I think we should be developing targeted and focused policies which try and address that. So say, for example, in the agriculture transition, we could have created a transition fund which allowed farmers to receive business advice, to invest in their business in other ways, grant schemes, all those sorts of things at a greater level than what we've had previously, so that businesses are becoming resilient in their own right and we don't need to have a payment associated with maintaining that. And I think the other thing which is just really key within this too is we spoke about the need for a fair and transparent supply chain, and the work of basic income for farmers talks about the fact that cheap food and I suppose this drive to reduce the cost of food is having all of these unintended consequences. One of the reasons that we can keep food so artificially low in price is because agriculture has been subsidized to quite a high tune for decades. And I think in calling for this, there is a potential that you undermine calls for greater regulation and on the supply chain itself.
And just on that idea of transitional payments, I mean, it wasn't a secret, was it, from 2016 onwards that this transition was going to happen? And so there's a degree to which, until those cap payments did tail off, there was a transitional payment effectively in place. And as you say, if you're struggling to talk to Treasury and talk to government, talk to the next government, whoever that is, to make the case for $6 billion going in to pay for the public goods that are necessary, then the idea of actually not having any conditions associated with that at all and just having money paid to farmers, I think is something that people really need to think very carefully about before really seriously considering that. But to be fair, we've been quite negative, or perhaps I've been quite negative, about the idea of a UBI. And it's worth just talking about what the purpose of a universal basic income is in the first place, because some people listening to the podcast might not have come across the term before. The idea of a UBI has been floated now for several years, possibly for a couple of decades, really. And the aim ultimately is to create a safety net for those who are on very low incomes, essentially to try and end poverty. And there is no doubt that there is poverty across the UK, that it has been rising, that there are an awful lot of children living in households where, you know, there isn't enough money to pay for food. And there are some farmers and farm businesses that are struggling in that way as well. But the idea that we should somehow fund a UBI for farmers and not for teachers or nurses or frankly for the Amazon delivery driver seems to me to be entirely the wrong conversation to be having at this point in time.
And I wouldn't disagree with you on that. And I think it's very difficult whenever, and let's be honest here, there are some farm businesses which are really struggling to make ends meet. And there are some farm businesses that are doing quite well and are still doing quite well and have done so for quite a considerable amount of time. And I think this points to the need, if we're going to try and intervene or address some of the issues here, we need to have targeted policies, and they need to almost be means tested to address a specific policy objective. Or if it's in the case of a universal basic income, then it is a universal basic income, because I think there is a risk in making the argument for one sector over the other whenever there are plenty of people working in plenty of professions which are finding it very, very difficult at the moment.
Yeah, absolutely. And as you say, Phil, farmers already do so much within the countryside to maintain it, with the onset of climate change and that need to reverse biodiversity loss, create regeneration in the countryside, we're going to need them to do so much more. And so we really need to be making the case, building a really strong case with the general public and for government, that we need more money coming from the public sector to pay for those things that the market is unable to value, at the same time as making sure that the market is fundamentally able to value good food production and good natural capital production. Really, at the same time as building that case with the general public, we need to build that case amongst the farming population as well, so that farmers really understand where that money can come from, the kind of changes that are expected of them, so that our countryside becomes more resilient in, frankly, the way that we've been talking about throughout this podcast. Let's take another break. And we're back, and we've got three research stories that we're going to finish the podcast with this week. Shall we start with the first one, Phil? That's always a good place to start. Research finds 10 times more pests in insecticide-treated cornfields. Tell us about that story.
Yes, so this piece of work is focused on research which is led by a small team of US researchers, which has aimed to identify the benefits of regenerative farming. So in particular, they've investigated the impact of natural pest management on corn production. And as you say, they found that pests were 10 times more abundant in insecticide-treated cornfields than on insecticide-free regenerative farming systems. So this is really bringing into question how useful it is to have monocultural kind of systems. So most cropland in the United States is characterized by large monocultures, and their productivity is largely maintained through a reliance on inputs, tillage, fertilizers, pesticides. And these have helped to deliver high levels of yield, but they've also made the system unresilient and vulnerable to pests. So what they found was pests were tenfold more abundant in insecticide-free cornfields, and that this indicates that farmers who proactively design pest-resilient food systems outperform farmers that react to pests chemically. And there's good evidence of this in a UK context as well, with farmers that are managing landscapes in a way which increases populations of pest predators and are adopting wider rotations, things like that, that they're actually having lower pest burden than those farms that are using insecticides themselves.
Thanks so much, Phil. And of course, this is a small study, and if it was in isolation, there might be a degree to which you know we disregard it. But this kind of study, this kind of information is being replicated around the world. And I remember a conversation that I had with Leontino Balbo, who produces, I think, a third of the world's organic sugar down in Brazil. And he talked about the way in which, before he became regenerative, he could have a single termite that would come along and devastate, you know, large proportions of his crop. Now, amongst the 570 or something arthropods that he has in his fields, he's got seven different types of termites, and they manage each other, and the crop is left unblemished. So, you know, it's really important stuff, this. And it brings us on to the second science story here, which is about in-field crop diversity helping to deliver ecological resilience. So we've got research being undertaken to determine whether Ethiopian farmers' age-old practice of planting and harvesting traditional grain mixtures could offer a climate resilient solution to global food insecurity. We have Morgan Rule, a professor of environmental science and policy from Clark University in the United States. And Professor Rule says, we're interested in how the diversity of the grains relates to climate adaptation. In some cases, the farmers are planting 5 to 7 different varieties of 2 different species in a single field. They're planted together, harvested together, used together, saved together, and then planted again the next year. So he's talking about the use of traditional grain mixtures known as maslins in France, where they were first cultivated during medieval times. These are self-evolutionary crops where the varieties compensate for each other depending on the climate and weather conditions in that particular year.
Yeah, this was really, really fascinating. So it's almost building climate adaptability into the crop itself. And yeah, these more diverse mixtures. So say, for example, you had one year where it was really, really dry. The varieties in the crop that do well under dry conditions become more dominant. And conversely, if it's really wet, the others that are, I suppose, more able to adapt to those systems take over as well. So it's kind of building in an insurance policy every time you're planting these together. And one of the things that they find from this is you would imagine that yields would generally be lower, but they've actually been quite stable over time. There's not been this boom and bust. And generally, the crop mixtures do quite well to withstanding challenges like pests, diseases, and in some cases, low soil quality as well. And one of the things that I found that was quite fascinating within this as well was just the impact on nutrient kind of density and things like that as well. So these farmers and these local communities which are planting them are finding that they will use certain mixes to deliver certain things. So I will give this special mixture to my wife after she gives birth is one of the quotes taken from it. But they can also look at a range of different health outcomes as well. So it might be quite useful for me in the coming months too.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, this refers back to conversations we were having earlier in the programme about whether this could be a solution in areas where you have higher levels of flooding or you have higher levels of drought, that you sort of build in that resilience by using a range of different seeds, a range of different varieties and types within an individual field. Let's move on to the final story, Phil. Urgent need for a new approach to combat global grassland degradation.
Yes, so we all know that globally grasslands are crucially important. So they're an important source of biodiversity, a range of different benefits to humans, including food production, water supply, carbon storage, all absolutely crucial. But this new piece of work that was published in the journal Nature Reviews Earth and Environment says that the future for our grasslands looks increasingly bleak unless we start to take really concerted and systemic action on it. So this was led by the University of Manchester, who brought together a team of international experts who have actually proposed a series of strategies to halt grassland degradation globally and to promote their restoration to meet sustainable development goals. And one of the things within this that I saw coming through frequently was the fact that, grasslands are often the poor cousin to other habitats, which are seen as more valuable from a carbon or food production perspective or whatever it would be. But this study highlights that the world's grasslands, which cover about 40% of the Earth's surface, are under massive threat from ongoing degradation, and they've been largely ignored by sustainable development goals. And the authors of this report point out that unless we start to turn the tide around, this is going to result in hundreds of millions of people being subject to a range of negative consequences. So say, for example, those people who are using grasslands for food, for fuel, for fibre, and also medicinal products. And let's not forget cultural values as well. So what this work has done has proposed a set of strategies to combat this degradation. And these include, first of all, increasing the recognition of grasslands in global policy, developing standardized indicators of degradation, using scientific innovation for effective restoration at both a regional and landscape scale, and enhancing knowledge transfer and data sharing on restoration experiences. And they argue that this is ultimately increasing in terms of its importance because of the ongoing impact of climate change, which is just exacerbating issues.
And one of the things that they say is that really we need to move to a situation where the policy attention, the level of attention that's given to this, needs to be on a par with forests that have had so much attention over the course of the last 20 or 30 years. Thanks so much, Phil. Well, I think that's pretty much all we've got time for today. I think we better end it because at some point you've got to go and have a baby.
That is true. That is true. I have to rush.
So we're not sure when we're going to be back, but we may be back in a fortnight. We may be back in 3, 4 or even 5 weeks. But as soon as we are, the podcast will appear in the feed if you are subscribed to Farmgate. So please make sure that you are. I've been Finlow Costain. Bye for now.
And I've been Phil Carson. Goodbye from me.